This Buddhist word emptiness, sunyata or shunyata in Sanskrit, refers to any experience or object or entity, being empty of what isn't there. And what isn't there is technically called svabhava, which means like one's own being or self-being, self-existence. And what it really points to is an essential true nature of a thing, like a person or an experience or an object, that, you know, that never changes, that defines that thing or person in an irrevocable sort of way. And mostly it comes down to, you know, things like identity. Like it matters with everything, right? It comes into the cup only being a cup in this fragile, brief, contingent moment in between really its long life as mud and fragments, you know. And there's this little moment where it has this kind of cup. But cup can't be its identity, because in any way other than in a kind of temporary, completely relational sort of way. You know, even if I give this cup to my friend and they, you know, plant some flowers in it, now you might be like, oh, nice planter, you know, nice flower pot. And so the label for the thing is relational. You know, I was writing this today about The Hobbit and riddles, so I'll keep going with Hobbit references here. But at the very end of The Hobbit, there's a bit where Bilbo goes back to the Shire, and he doesn't really fit in to the pastoral Shire. He's had way too many adventures. And they said, you know, he never again was quite all right to the hobbits. In fact, he was, you know, from this point on, rather queer. I'm like, yeah, Bilbo was queer. So, you know, there's a word that has meant a lot of things. And, it meant something different in the Shire, perhaps, than it means here. It's hard to say exactly what it means in a book where there are literally zero female characters. So there's that to contend with in Tolkien's world. But it doesn't mean what it means when I use the word to refer to myself and my friends, almost certainly. And so, you know, the place that we get hung up and suffer very often is with concepts and names that carry emotional and social and political and, you know, relational force. You know, I'm this kind of person. I am this person, you know, and I like these kinds of people, and I'm married to this kind of person, and I'm a parent now, and, you know, I vote for these kinds of people and certainly not those kinds of people. And you know, people with my skin color get treated one way in some parts of the world and then other ways in other parts of the world. And people, you know, all of these, in a certain way, we could look at so many, I'm tempted to say all, but I'll be slightly conservative and say most, you know, big problems in the world right now. And that in some way we can trace them down to the people wanting the names for things to be what they want. You know, people want material things. You know, Putin wants income from Ukrainian grain exports, you know, or who knows what. But he also wants, you know, a label, you know, called something like the Russian Empire is this big or this meaningful or this powerful, a certain narrative, a name for things, you know. You know, how many decades have we been fighting over what the names man and woman refer to? And still, you know, our feeds are full of essentially an ongoing argument about whether those names refer to an intrinsic characteristic that some people carry. And it's that way with all of the identity names, you know, and the names cause so much sorrow, so much suffering. You know, part of what emptiness recognizes, this is really, a couple of you touched on this very beautifully in your reflections, that the word is so insufficient in its describing of a thing that it, you know, it's almost useless. And you know, some thinkers in Zen and other places will arrive at this conclusion that language is nearly useless, at least in terms of mystical experience or, you know, an enlightenment kind of experience. You know, the verses of the Faith Mind by the third Zen patriarch, Tseng Tsan, ends with, you know, words, the great way is beyond language. And that's a common sentiment in, you know, in Zen, as well as in, you know, the other, many of the other non-dual traditions like Advaita and the traditions that sprang from it. You know, in all of the mystical traditions, East and West, North and South, there's at some point a recognition that language falls short in the describing of the real, of what's real. And so emptiness in a way is just this, you know. And so in reflecting on the Hobbit today, you know, I was going off on riddles and the sense that I was, you know, feeling into how there's the riddle, which is this little, you know, like ambiguous idiosyncratic poem that describes a thing in this kind of figurative language and obliquely points to it. But the whole fun of a riddle is that it doesn't use the word that names the thing. And the puzzle of the riddle is that you have to figure out what the word is. What is the word, you know? And in feeling into those, almost like they let me feel backwards into emptiness, because the word is this, like I think I know what the word means, you know, mountain or fish or sun or flower, and or Sean, you know, for that matter, right? Or David or Joni, like those words, I think I know what they mean. And they have meaning partly because we share, you know, an agreement about what they mean. Right? If I say David, you all know who in this room I might be talking about. But, you know, this person already admitted themselves that the word is a mystery, you know. I did a thing that a lot of folks in my generation that I know have done, but not very many in my parents' generation that I know of had done. And I changed my last name when I got married, and to my dear father's somewhat dismay, but it was, I loved doing it. And part of what was interesting about it, which, you know, is an experience that half the population has been socially conditioned to expect to do, whether they do it or not, and half the population has been, at least around here and in American culture, conditioned not to do so, I got to experience this thing of like, oh yeah, I just like, you know, my sweetheart and I just made up a name and we put it on ourselves. And now we've been wearing it for, you know, a decade and a half or so. And it's really mysterious. Every once in a while I look at it written on the paper or I hear myself say it and I'm like, is that me? Why would it be me? But why wouldn't it refer to me? When I found out that I was adopted at birth, which I was. I found out quite late in life. Well, I knew early in my life that I was adopted, but I found out quite late in life that my birth mother had named me, and I had a first birth certificate. And on my first birth certificate, I was named something else entirely. And that's strange, right? And I was named something by my mother, who is an important figure in my young life, who I knew for one day. And then a day later, I was given a new birth certificate with a new name. And that's odd. So, you know, which name refers to me? So if you want to know, for one day at the beginning of my life, my name was Matthew Pierce. And I lived in Peoria, Illinois. And one day later, my name was Sean Fite, and I lived in somewhere else, wherever they were, down in the south of the state. And very shortly after that, I became Californian and stayed here ever since. What is identity? You know, I was raised by white people, and I was raised thinking that I was white, which is to say, whiteness or brownness or anything about race was never mentioned to me. And so I never had a thought about it until I was, you know, in my mid-20s, and I learned that I was Puerto Rican, at least in part. And occasionally someone would point out to me that I was, that I actually looked different than other folks that I thought that I was kin with. So what we find then is that the name for a thing always fails to completely describe the thing. But even more than that, what emptiness says is just remember that the thing, and here thing again means entity, object, person, experience, concept, that all of these things are fundamentally undefinable or unfixable, can't be fixed, right? No label can define the thing. Therefore, the thing is empty of intrinsic meaning, or svabhava, self-being, intrinsic being. The implication of this, you know, in the Mahayana teachings is that when we have the view that sees through the lens of emptiness, once we learn to remember this, I think the training is really just not to forget that this is so. You know, we can talk about it here and logically it makes sense. This is a kind of philosophical conversation. This is really basic semiotics and postmodernism. It makes sense logically. But then, you know, I go out and I have a conversation with my sweetheart, or I watch the news, or I look in the mirror. I do something that has social, relational, you know, ethical, or, you know, identity kind of force to it. And the story comes, you know, flooding back in, and, you know, and I believe that I am this thing, and they are this thing, and you are this thing, and, you know, she is that thing, and that all of the words then pin down the meaning of the thing, you know, and that's from the Mahayana perspective, that's actually the thing that causes suffering, that causes dukkha. Right? In the most basic formulation, in the Noble Truths, it's it's grasping, tanha, thirst, a kind of unquenchable impulse of attachment that gives rise to dissatisfaction, dukkha, suffering. With emptiness as the lens, the thing that gives rise to suffering is that the thing that we're attached to is the meaning of things. You know, I'm attached to a certain relationship, not just because the sensations are pleasant when I'm in contact with a person or a group, but that that pleasantness is created in large part by the narrative of what it means, you know? So like, I love this person and I love being with them. That could engender some attachment. But the idea that I've found my beloved, or that I belong, or that I've found certainty or home or permanence or a refuge, those concepts carry a lot of emotional force. And so, you know, like, I love being sheltered from the rain. It rained here yesterday as well. I was very happy laying in my bed in the rain, not wet and cold. So that was a basic, you know, physical comfort. I can be attached to that. But the concept, you know, home, I'm home. This is my place. You know, I belong here. I'm of this land, or, you know, I own this land, which I don't, the land that I'm on. But, you know, I've been haunted by the desire to own my home for a very long time. And that concept has caused a lot of suffering. You know, the concept is going to carry all of this force. And so then, to the extent that we get attached to the concept, to the name of the thing, then dukkha, then suffering, is inevitable, right? So that's where, with emptiness as the lens, I'll see how attachment and then suffering unfold. Where I think we then can let this both rest and become a kind of practice is that there's one layer where our practice becomes I wrote about this morning as the first insight, really, in the Theravadin system. This is the first of 16 insights called the progress of insight, or the unfolding of insight. And this is an insight called Nama Rupa. Nama means the name of the thing, the label, the idea, the concept, the identity. And Rupa is form, form visible by the eyes, but also just visible through the physical senses. So there's physical experiences, and then there's meanings ascribed to them. And in this sense, you know, like, emotion and narrative are all part of name. You know, emotion in a certain way has a physical experience aspect, so it bridges the two a bit. But much of the time, the emotion or the mood or the reactivity is responding to the name of the thing. It's responding to meaning. So, you know, if someone insults me, that might hurt my feelings, you know, briefly. But if I'm carrying a narrative in which, you know, I often get insulted in this way, or I'm afraid that that insult is true because I have a self-image of being a certain way, all of that narrative is then, right, going to compound the hurt. I did this a lot when I was a child, right? Somebody was rude to me, and that means that I'm such and such, or I'm like this, or they're like this, or we're like this. And so there's a first layer of practice where we practice disentangling the name from the experience. And this is, you know, this is one of the things that just basic mindfulness does for us. You know, it says attend to, you know, present moment sensory and emotional experience as it unfolds. And if you're doing that, right, as one of you reflected on so beautifully in the sharing, while you're doing that, you can't be lost in narrative and in concept about things, because when mindfulness is bright, it cuts through that extra layer. And so mindfulness then leads very directly to the recognition of this Nama Rupa insight, because I can perceive, oh, I'm seeing this and I'm thinking this, you know, And without mindfulness, without that insight, the sensory experience and the meaning that swims around it, they get bound together. They come together. So I see you and I immediately think I know what this means. Mindfulness comes in and it uncouples those two things. And it says there's seeing and there's cognizing, and they're different. Right? And they're, because they're both conditioned, they can change, right? The meaning of seeing you can change day to day. Of course it can, right? Once I uncouple those, there's this spaciousness, because meaning turns out to have a lot of slippage to it, right? Meaning is pretty flimsy. My mood shifts very slightly, and the sight of my beloved means a totally different thing, you know? My kid's mood shifts very slightly, and the meaning of dad to him means an entirely different thing, and he tells me so, you know? All of the meanings get unbound. So then our practice becomes first to get good at that, because that alone will unbind some layers of suffering. Then, of course, we're still living in the world. Like, everything is still functioning. People still need things from you and want things of you, and everybody still thinks they mean something. God bless them, dear ones. And so we live in a world where we have to interact with meanings all the time. And folks don't like their meaning being uprooted. So if you go around just telling everybody you know that everything they think is true is actually a slippage of intrinsically empty phenomena, you know, it's just not that helpful, right? And so the concept of the bodhisattva, the being, the awakening being seeing everything through the lens of emptiness, is always conjoined with the bodhisattva acting with infinite skill in means, upaya kaushalya, skillful means. Upaya is like, right, knowing this, knowing that meaning and experience are always in a dynamic, changing relationship with each other. Your task then is not to live in emptiness only, but to live in emptiness while practicing skillful engagement. So how do you engage with people? If you start to become free of the meanings of things, you actually have quite a bit of mobility to engage with folks who are stuck in meanings. And then, of course, you figure out that you're also stuck in some meanings, and you work on that. And, you know, and there becomes this beautiful, I think, just a loosening, really, of fixation. And with the loosening of fixation, there's just more that we can do. There's more that we can be present with and flow with in relationship with others. So then the paradox, or the riddle at the heart of all of it, that everything is empty, but it still matters. And your actions matter even though they're empty. They matter because they affect people. And the effect is real, right? Our actions have an impact, even though the meaning of that impact is contingent and slipping. So we'll pause there.